Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
Oh, yeah, it's great to be with you again as we explore the exciting world of the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation, all of it right here at the Science News Radio Network. Remind you that those of you listening on radio, you can also hear us commercial-free and webcast at promiseoftomorrow.biz. An exciting show today. We're going to visit the Den of Strangers, visit our fountain of useless information we have here on the set, and of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. And in just a minute, I'm going to introduce you to Steve Carr. He's director of proteomics at MIT and Harvard, the Broad Institute, and he's going to be a speaker at PitCon. And those of you who know a little bit about PitCon know that it's a very exciting traveling show. Registration is now open at PitCon, and there's more about that a little later on in the program. And then Dr. Christine Lee, we found her. She's with NASA and the Applied Sciences Program. We found Christine at her home on October 1st. They set her home because the government closed. So... anyway, that's to be expected, I guess. Anyway, she's a speaker at the Global Humanitarian Technology Conference. It's going on in another couple of weeks, at October 20th through the 23rd at the San Jose Airport Garden Hotel in California. You'll enjoy hearing her. But right now, let's get on to today's guests.
Stand by.
Right now, we're really lucky we have with us Steve Carr. He's director of the proteomics at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard. And I don't know much about what proteomics is about, but he's going to tell us. I understand that Steve works with a diverse group whose main purpose is transforming medicine and biomedical research. And so this is going to be really, really fascinating. Steve is a speaker, a presenter at PitCon. Those of you familiar with PitCon know that it moves around a lot. This year it's going to be at the McCormick Place in Chicago, March 2 through 6. And you can find out more about PitCon, if you don't know much about it, at pitcon.org. It's PITTCON.ORG. They've evolved into a conference and expo that now serves a diverse constituency on life sciences, pharmaceutical discovery, food safety, environmental, and all sorts of different things. So enjoy PitCon. And right now, we're going to meet Steve Carr. Thanks for being with us, Steve.
Thank you very much for the invite, Colonel.
Now, there's a lot of questions, you know, and before we get into it, could you kind of give us a little background on what the Broad Institute at MIT and Harvard, what they're doing? I mean, you've got MIT and Harvard working together with this institute. You've been around for about 10 years or so. Give us a little background on that.
Yes, that's correct. We are approaching our 10th anniversary this coming year. So we were founded late 2004. Mm-hmm. It was started, really began with a conversation with our director, who is Eric Lander, with a number of people around the country about what could be done to much more rapidly advance biomedical sciences. Okay. And of course, Eric was one of the principals involved in sequencing of the human genome. His thought was, what can we do to leverage the enormous amount of genomic information that is being produced with looking toward therapeutic and patient impact? So that conversation, as I said, started in 2000 and probably early 2002. Mm-hmm. And ultimately culminated in the formation of the Broad. Now, the Broad is funded through a generous gift from Eli and Edith Broad in California. They gave the initial starting funds for the institute, but it was with the strict requirement that MIT and Harvard contribute equally to the initial founding gift, either in kind or through various services, and that, more importantly, scientifically, Broad, they be integrated with the Broad environment.
Okay.
So Broad is unusual in the sense that we have, you know, roughly closing in on 1,000 people who are in the Institute proper, but really the Broad Institute is much larger than the physical Broad itself, because importantly we have associate member memberships, and these are professors, postdocs, students coming from our associated associated academic institutions and hospitals. So all 17 Harvard-affiliated hospitals are part of this: MIT, Harvard Medical School, Harvard Faculty of Arts and Sciences are all components of the Broad. So scientifically, we engage in projects with all of those groups, and more importantly, the associate member labs, together with people at the Broad, help define and drive where the science should go. So there's a lot of nucleation and idea generation around specific disease areas like cancer, psychiatric disease, infectious disease, etc.
Oh, I love that word, nucleation. I mean, that's a great word. I learned a new word from you today, Steve. Wonderful. So you're a really extensive organization based on the human genome and for the solving of diseases. This has got to be absolutely riveting for you. I mean, this is a fascinating study. Now, how does proteomics get into this, and why have a number of us don't know what some he's talking about when they start talking about proteomics? Is this a new study?
So it's a great series of questions, Colonel. Let me try to answer those sort of in some logical order.
All right.
So the genome, of course, is the blueprint for what proteins are going to be expressed in your body, and mutations in those genes can result in modified or changed forms of proteins, and can also change the modifications of those proteins. So proteins aren't—they're not active in a kind of a naked state. In other words, just the amino acid sequence, which is what the gene actually initially codes for. Very often, they have extensive modifications that can include things like phosphate groups, otherwise known as phosphorylation. They can have modifications like sugars, which is glycosylation. But there are on the order of 200 different known such modifications, some of which are very much known to be involved in signaling and disease pathogenesis, like cancer, infectious disease, cardiovascular disease, etc. So where does proteomics come into this? Well, the genes are simply the blueprint. It doesn't say what does happen, it says what could happen. In order to understand what is happening, you have to, at some point, look at the protein constituency of the cell, the tissue, the biofluid, whatever the organism is that you're trying to study. And most of the work that goes on here is focused on, of course, mammalian systems, because we're interested in impacting human patient health. So proteomics is the study of the proteins that are being coded by those genes, and not just the study of which ones are present, but also the relative amounts of those proteins under specific conditions, certain states, such as a disease state or a state of health. Perhaps it's also a state of development from embryonic to fully developed organism. So all proteomics is today, or most proteomics today, is done in a comparative fashion, where we are trying to determine in a quantitative manner the change in the protein composition of a cell, a tissue, or biofluid in state A versus state B, C, D, whatever any number that you want to come up with. And today, very large studies are being done that look at multiple perturbation states, multiple time courses. Some of those perturbations, for example, could be drug treatments. So if you're trying to understand what the direct impact on the proteome of administration of an anti-cancer drug or an anti-diabetic compound. One of the methods that you want to employ is proteomics. Now, as I said, proteins are heavily modified. So one of the things that proteomics can do that genomics cannot do is to detect and tell you where and at what levels the various modifications are on these proteins. So proteomics is highly complementary to genomic methods, but we leverage the underlying genomics information.
All right, and for clarification, Steve, and let me see if I can understand this, because I'm the dumbest guy around here. I mean, the thing is that everybody who listens to the program and everybody who guests on the program all are smarter than me. So I'm the guy who gets to ask all the stupid questions. But I guess what you're saying is that we study the genome and we can find out what can happen, but we don't know what's going to happen. So when you get into proteomics, what you're doing is you're trying to establish what's going to happen and how you can treat what that might be. Is that a simple explanation?
I think it's a reasonable explanation. I mean, another way to put it is the proteome or the protein composition of an organism is the business end of the genome.
The business end of the genome, and by that you mean that is where things are going to happen. That is where the disease is going to come from. Is that right?
That's right. So it'll be manifested. Ultimately, the disease is manifested in changed protein compositions and really changed function of the proteins. So beyond developing that, you know, proteomics at one level is a cataloging exercise in different perturbational states with a quantitative overlay. You then have to extend that and say, okay, what do we now know about the proteins or their modifications that are clearly being changed in the presence of disease? How can we bring that back to function? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's where you need quite a bit of biological insight, but proteomics methods are hypothesis generating exercises that really focus you in on a small subset of the proteome or modifications of the proteome that are changing and relevant to a particular disease or drug effect. And that then triggers hypothesis driven experiments where you know these things are involved and you have to do follow-on studies. Some of those can then go back to using genomic-based approaches like various knockdown methods where you basically use genomic tools to decrease the level or completely knock out the presence of a particular protein mm-hmm. or gene product.
Okay.
There are all sorts of ways of doing this. Some of them involve various silencing mechanisms using RNA. Others are actually modifying these genes now through methods such as CRISPR. So there are lots of things that have to happen after proteomics in order to get to true functional understanding. But proteomics itself is a way of honing in on what the key actors are, the things which are actually causing the disease or directly related to the disease or drug effect. And you can't do that, or it's not so easy to do that directly from genomic methodologies.
Well, wow, as director of proteomics with the Broad Institute, and you've got got 1,000 people around you to deal with, and then you have all of these other institutions who are working in genomics, you have to navigate through the minds of an awful lot of very different people. How do you manage it all? Do people report into you with some sort of a dramatic finding or question or something like that, and then you've got to go ahead and coordinate with other people that you know of in your network? Or how does all this work?
That's a terrific question too. So, you know, the Broad is an incredibly collaborative institution, mm-hmm. and I head up a component that's referred to as a platform technology, within the Institute. So proteomics is viewed as a capability, a technology that can and should be leveraged broadly across studies.
Okay.
So the Institute was founded with this collaborative spirit in mind, and I often describe the place as it's where people come who want to solve the most important problems in science, and they leave their weapons at the door. You know, these are the psychological weapons,
okay,
not the physical ones.
Yeah.
That then allow them to collaborate and coordinate on projects in order to get a very difficult problem solved. And that generally requires a matrixed approach to science. It's not just genomics, it's not just proteomics, it's not just, you know, chemical biology, but it's the integration and the coordination of all of those things together that help solve very complex problems. I think that's sort of generally understood now in science, that this is a highly matrixed enterprise, particularly as we try to tackle really difficult diseases like cancer and diabetes. So the way, to get more specific and answer your question, how do we function on a day-to-day basis, like there are a number of other platform technologies within the Broad, so what I'm telling you is will apply to these other platform technologies as well. We really, you know, we reach out to groups that are, so we have regular programmatic meetings on a weekly basis where cancer program, infectious disease program, psychiatric disease program, metabolic disease program, and there are quite a few others, get together. These include people from the various partner institutions as well as Broad scientists who have self-selected because they want to be part of that community. There are these run as large group meetings with participants coming and talking about not just stuff that's already been published. In fact, they are meant to present the latest science that they're working on, so
Oh, really? There's
always the admonition that, you know, this is stuff that hasn't been published yet. If you want to talk about it, please communicate directly with the presenter. Don't talk about this outside the room.
Sure.
But what this allows for is, first off, it creates enormous excitement because this is the latest you know, stuff that's going on, not something that's old and already published.
Sure.
Secondly, you've got the group of people in that room who are thinking about how to solve these problems. And there's an enormous amount of discussion that happens where, and frequently, those conversations lead to sort of directed research efforts, either you know, through some small modicum of funding that comes from the Broad Institute itself, or if it's already more than half-baked, we might go out and try to apply for grant funding through federal or foundation sources in order to get the project off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very collaborative in terms of how the science gets going, and proteomics is generally part of those discussions at a very early stage, how we're going to use this in the context of the work that they want to do. So that's one way projects start. Another way, a very common way, is for collaborators who've heard about proteomics because it's been presented in these team meetings
Yeah.
as part of a way to solve or approach a particular problem. They hear about us, they come and they call me up or
Mm-hmm.
Some of the other scientists in my group. I've got about 20 people in the laboratory, and they all function as ambassadors of the science that we do. So they may contact myself or one of the other scientists in the group, and you know, we have a conversation about what it is that they're trying to do. And of course, as you alluded to, we can't possibly understand all of the science that goes on. We have to understand enough about the particular disease or chemical biology or systems biological study that they want to do.
Yeah.
You need to understand enough about it in order to be able to come up with the appropriate experimental design in order to achieve the analytical goals that they're trying to achieve. So yes, I always say that we live kind of a schizophrenic existence because we don't do one thing all the time. We do 100 things part of the time. So it is very difficult to stay on top of all the science, but the way we do that is by having individuals in the group that sort of focus on particular disease areas so they can become a little bit more expert in that area. And otherwise, we're just kind of regularly juggling the information that's in our heads to understand the new biology that we're being asked to help them solve. So it's complex, but it's very energizing, and it's never boring.
Absolutely. I mean, just talking with you on the program, I can feel this energy and this excitement, because the ideas that are being spread around from all these great minds that are working on these things has got to be just so exciting and riveting. And at the same time, you've got to be careful that you're not overwhelmed with so much excitement and so many things going on. So prioritizing, I could imagine, is got to be probably one of your biggest chores. And you mentioned to leave their weapons at the door. What you really mean is leave their biases at the door. Is that right?
That's right, and egos as well.
And egos as well. Yes, I hadn't thought about that. But
yeah, scientists, like everybody else, have enormous egos. And you know, the way science has traditionally been done, it's my laboratory. My R01, my investigator-driven grant, I have all of the resources I need to solve my problem in my group. Occasionally, I might have to go outside and get some help, but generally, it's driven from that investigator's laboratory. And I think increasingly, it's becoming more and more difficult to maintain that kind of approach, particularly for much more complex diseases, as I've already mentioned. And you need resources which really go, resources, and I mean by resources, not just technologies, but really, the domain expertise, clinical, chemical, biological, that you may not have within your own particular group.
Wow.
So by being able to come to a place that kind of openly, in fact, is philosophically designed from the ground up to be collaborative and to ensure that those resources in these various areas are brought to bear on any particular problem is a different way of thinking for a lot of scientists. But once they experience it, they love it. So it's a different way of operating. So you may not know this, but you know, I came out of a pharmaceutical and biotech background.
Okay.
So, of course, in pharma and in biotech, you're very used to solving problems through matrixed organizations. No one group solves the problem. You kill the problem by bringing the right group of people together and giving them the necessary resources that they need to solve the problem. And I think philosophically, the Broad is very much has that kind of industrialized mindset, that it takes a certain amount and capacity level across a number of different areas of science in order to tackle very difficult problems. But the coin of the realm here is not necessarily to put a drug on the market. I say that, but in fact, ultimately we may in fact do that, accomplish that. There are efforts. We have compounds, in fact, in late-stage clinical trials that came out of early research efforts from here at the Broad.
Oh, really?
But really the main driver is to accelerate the understanding of the diseases to the point where it's clear what you have to do in order to address that particular disorder in a patient. And that might be from a therapeutic, it might be from a genomic standpoint, it might be discovering a marker of the presence of that disease so that treatment can be initiated as early as possible and reduce mortality and improve outcomes for patients.
I'm learning so much today from you, Steve. Thank you. This is wonderful. I mean, this is really, really good. And, of course, when I mentioned the biases and then you reminded me. Well, I've been given the cue. We have to take a break, but we'll be back to expand more on that thought right after this. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all the wisdom of mankind. In the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
Yes, yes, Patrick Henry. The Constitution is not an instrument for the government to restrain the people. It is an instrument for the people to restrain the government, unless it comes to dominate our lives and interests.